from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Money is powerful, but does money buy happiness, love, or even sex? A new flock of answers is on its way from the fast-growing field of happiness economics. More money, say economists and psychologists on this new frontier, does make you happier to a point. But as America has become ever richer in the last half century, Americans haven't really become much happier. In some cases, just the opposite. So what's going on? Tonight on Point, the economics of happiness, sex, money, power, commuting time, and the elements of well-being. But first tonight, we go to Washington, where just moments ago, members of the Senate approved landmark buyout legislation that will allow the Food and Drug Administration to place new restrictions on cigarette makers and pay tobacco farmers $12 billion to give up federal subsidies propping up their prices. The proposal passed in a 78-15 vote. Joining me now for a closer look at the measure is Elizabeth Shogren, staff writer for the LA Times. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening.
Everybody's calling it landmark. Why? What's the big deal here?
Well, for the first time, it would give the FDA power to regulate what's actually in the cigarettes. The FDA could, with this new legislation, if it's passed, decide that cigarettes should even have less nicotine, for instance, or that they shouldn't have as much tar. And that it would give them power to actually know what's going on in cigarettes, which has remained secret for all this time, the actual components of it.
So they'd be regulating cigarettes something like they regulate food and drugs?
Yes, exactly. And it would also give them power to regulate the advertisements and the sales and the distribution of these cigarettes. The particular goal is to keep the cigarettes out of the hands of kids because 90% of Americans who smoke started smoking as children, and 40 million Americans are addicted to cigarettes.
So it would give the FDA huge new powers to get in there and be on top of what's going on with cigarettes, both their content, what's in them, and how they're marketed. What has the government given the tobacco industry in return for that enormous new power?
Well, what they're offering, in at least with this legislation, is a $12 billion buyout that would end the current system, which gives that sets price supports and gives quotas to farmers. And in exchange for getting rid of that, which farmers use as an asset now in the system, it's too complicated to explain, but it's now considered an asset by farmers, that they would get all this money instead, $12 billion, and it would make some of these farmers millionaires or add to the millions they already have. And so there were some skeptics about this. But the money, at least in the Senate version of the bill, would come from big tobacco companies. And the House passed a similar bill that had the buyout of the tobacco companies, but no FDA regulation power. And that was paid for with taxpayer money. So now they have to go and decide in a conference of what the final legislation will be that will go to the president's desk.
So not at all clear what will come out of conference committee. But Elizabeth, if it goes through something like the Senate has described, what would that mean for tobacco farmers? Would it essentially take tobacco farmers or some of them out of business? Would they just consider this a buyout and move to another crop? Can they have a profitable business without government supports and quotas?
Well, it's interesting because I think buyout is a confusing term, because usually when you talk about a buyout, it means that you can't do the job anymore. But in fact, they're getting this buyout and they would still be permitted to keep growing tobacco. They predict that a lot of people wouldn't grow tobacco anymore, but certainly many would. And they think that it would make them more competitive because they actually have to pay for this quota if they don't already own it. And so by taking that reducing the money that they now spend on the quota, they could theoretically sell tobacco for less money, and that would make them more competitive with foreign tobacco growers, which is part of the problem that this is attempting to address, is that tobacco growers in the U.S. think they're not competitive anymore and are struggling to make a living.
And finally, Elizabeth, what about the southern states, the tobacco states? Are there senators on board? Were they in the vote this evening?
Oh, yes. Senators, even those who said that they were against the tobacco regulation, were voting for this because they're for the buyout. And on the other hand, you have senators who are big public health advocates voting for the buyout because they want the regulation. They want FDA to be able to regulate tobacco. And so it was interesting. You see people voting for things that they normally would never vote.
Well, a landmark move in the Senate. We'll be watching that conference committee. Elizabeth Shogren, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Elizabeth Shogren is a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Washington. We're looking at happiness tonight, maybe in a whole new way. A group of economists and psychologists in the hot field of happiness economics are pushing for the creation of so-called national well-being indicators. More rich and subtle measures would track a country's happiness in the same way that gross domestic product tracks a country's economic strength. Pure economics, they say, cannot explain the fact that the U.S. is now three times richer than it was at the end of World War II, but that Americans are scarcely happier than they were then. And in fact, younger Americans are more anxious and more stressed out. Good health, good friends, a good marriage, good sex, even a swift commute to work, all have a value that in money terms can be huge but invisible by traditional economic measurements. Tonight on Point, the economics of happiness, sex, money, power, inner peace, and the elements of well-being. Do you buy it? Could we, should we have a national happiness index? How would you calculate it? Can we measure happiness, put a price on it, and what would it say about our current priorities if we did? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is David Blanchflower, professor of economics at Dartmouth College and co-author of a recent study, Money, Sex, and Happiness, an Empirical Study. Good evening and welcome, Professor Blanchflower.
Hello there.
Hi, great to have you with us. Also joining us tonight from Champaign, Illinois, is Ed Diener, professor of psychology at the University of Illinois and co-author of a recent study, Beyond Money, Toward an Economy of Well-Being. Good evening and welcome, Ed Diener.
Good evening.
Great to have you. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Great to have you with us.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guests.
So here we are, and we've been reading a very kind of excited and hot interpretation of what you, David Blanchflower, and you, Ed Diener, are on about. I hope you can put it to us in a nutshell, what you're seeing and where you're proposing we go with it. First to you, David Blanchflower, what have you found in your recent study that should get our attention about economics, about happiness, about where the two might meet?
Well, I first of all should say that Ed Diener is really the expert in this because psychologists have been working in this area for decades, and economists are new to the game. But we're trying to use their expertise to look at how things move over time and try to get measures of how the wealth of the economy, if you like, how well people are feeling, and trying to, as you said in the introduction, think about ways perhaps of getting a happiness index for the economy. So these are very early days for us, and we're building on the expertise of psychologists, particularly Professor Diener, and we're trying particularly to put money values on things and try to understand particularly non-labor market things, how non-economic things appear to be incredibly important. And for economists, that's in a sense a bit of a shock. But we're trying to come to happiness from being the dismal science, and we don't want to be the dismal science anymore.
Well, it certainly isn't dismal with your new title and some of your findings. I hope you can explain them to us. For example, we read in your study that you find that a lasting marriage, if you translate it into monetary terms, and I'd like you to explain to us how you do that, is worth the equivalent of something like $100,000 a year. That sex once a week is worth $50,000 a year. How do you go about creating a matrix that connects those two things?
Well, that's a big question. The big starting point, I think, for all of this work is to think about how much happiness does money bring. The evidence that we see, and particularly building on psychologists' work, is that money brings some amounts of happiness, but not as much as economists would have thought. And we've had to look to psychologists and realize that really other things matter. So what we've tried to do is to think about how much happiness, if you like, how many units of happiness a dollar of income would buy, and then say, okay, let's look at other things like marriage and unemployment, and later on, more recently, we've worked on sex. Try to think about what the equivalent units of happiness, if you like, you would be able to get from a good marriage compared with what you get from income. So we, as economists, we like to scale things. We like to get measures of things. So we're literally trying to think about, if you like, you had to replace this event with money, what would it take? How much money would it take?
Okay.
And what we see is that non-economic things have incredibly high money value, and money buys a little bit of happiness, but lots of other things bring enormous amounts of happiness, much more than we as economists had ever thought. And I guess I have to say we have to bow to the psychologists who told us that all the time, and they were probably right.
Ed Diener, let us turn to you. You're the psychologist here and the guru, as David Blanche Flower says. What's the frontier we're pushing toward with this perspective, with this attitude or path of investigation of economics and happiness?
Well, I think what we're pushing for is a set of indicators like the economic indicators. And right now, of course, we have GDP and we have dozens of economic indicators. We don't have well-being indicators, how engaged people are, interested in what they're doing, lack of stress, happiness, life satisfaction, satisfaction with marriage. We don't have those. And so what we're proposing is that the economic indicators be complemented by an additional set of indicators, and that would help not only policymakers, but it would help individuals. And way back, even before the psychologists, I got into this, Robert Kennedy had a quote, and he said, you know, the GDP is indifferent to the decency of our factories and the safety of streets alike. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. The GDP measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom, neither our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except that what makes life worthwhile. So what we're proposing then is that we go beyond the GDP type of measures and include some of these other things. And in fact, what we think may be common to the things that Kennedy was talking about are people's subjective well-being, their feelings that their life is going well.
Well, it may be true that GDP doesn't capture that, but I'm looking here at a chart of happiness and per capita income. This is Graham and Pettinato, 2002. I'm sure you've seen it. And all the very happiest countries on this chart are pretty high per capita income countries. The USA, Canada, Switzerland, Sweden, Japan, Netherlands, New Zealand, Ireland. I mean, others are up there, but money does seem to pretty pronounced effect.
Sure, so we don't want to replace use happiness to replace economic measures. But what you'll also notice on that chart you're looking at is that after about $10,000 per capita per year, the chart's pretty flat. You don't get much more rise.
Absolutely.
So where you get the rise, the steep rise, is typically in the very poor countries. So India getting more income now so that people have enough to eat. So at those levels, you get steep rises. Then at the higher levels, we've seen only the tiniest bit of rises with doubling or tripling of income.
We're going to have to come back and look at how money and happiness relate exactly. But Jack Beattie, I want to get you in here. Are you prepared to put a price tag on the glory of your marriage, Jack, or even more intimate aspects of your marriage?
Oh, not now, Tom. I've got a headache.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
But here it is. Here it is. The nexus is where these guys are shining their spotlight, Jack.
I've heard of the cash nexus. This is something else. You know, I was recently listening to Lyndon Johnson's tapes and to his speech on the Great Society delivered in 1965 at Ann Arbor. And which, I mean, you know, we tend to think of the Great Society as about poverty. Really, it was about the quality of life. He said, we can't just measure our success by numbers. We have to do it by the quality of our choices, our inner culture, our existential experience, our friendships. And, you know, if a current president talked like that, you just
hoot,
say,
hoot.
Yeah, I mean, he'd be wooted off the stage. I mean, when Hillary Clinton dared to use the phrase, the politics of meaning, people just jumped all over her.
Well,
have really lost this vocabulary.
We'll come back and see if we can regain a little bit of it on a new frontier, the economics of happiness. Listeners, you can join us. Do you buy it? Can happiness, that elusive thing, be quantified? Can you put a dollar value on it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the economics of happiness, about sex, money, power, commuting, and the elements of well-being. You can join the conversation. Does your marriage, for example, produce $100,000 worth of happiness a year, as the recent study we're talking about tonight suggests? Where do you turn for happiness? Sex, money, power, yoga? Would sex once a week give you a $50,000 happiness pop? Another finding of this study. And when we obsess about the GDP, are we obsessing on the wrong thing? Should we have an Alan Greenspan for the measurement of national well-being, of national happiness? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Champaign, Illinois, by Ed Diener, professor of psychology at the University of Illinois, and from Hanover, New Hampshire, by David Blanchflower, professor of economics at Dartmouth College. They each have recent studies out on happiness and economics, or happiness economics, the new phrase that we hear. David Blanchflower, I wish you'd take us into exactly how you did your study. I'm still a little bit at a loss to see how you pulled together dollar figures and these more subtle human activities or relationships that you hang happiness around.
Well, economists generally, unlike psychologists, don't go and themselves interview subjects. They make use of data that other people have collected. And in this case, we've made use of the General Social Survey. And it's a great attraction to economists, as this survey's been conducted every year since the 1970s. And we ask people, the researchers ask people how happy they feel. And we have information on that over time. And we then try and work out what the influences are on people's answers about them being happy. And we know their income, and we know all sorts of characteristics about them. And our basic input to this, our contribution, I suppose, to this, is to say economists want to scale things somehow. How much happiness does money bring, and how much do other activities bring? And so we're trying to put a unit of measurement in. Traditionally, economists use money. It's not something really so much I think psychologists use, but there's a very big area of overlap between us. And so we try to look at what are the principal influences on making people happy or less happy.
And what did you find?
Well, we found a number of things. We found a whole series of results, like women traditionally have been happier than men, but their happiness has declined over time. They've become more equal, more like men, but relatively less happy. We found that African Americans are less happy. We found that happiness is U-shaped in age. What does that mean? Well, it means that people are happiest when they're young, happiest when they're old, and least happy when they're 40. And fortunately for somebody like me, I'm on the upward sloping part of my happiness function.
Good for you,
so,
I guess.
Yes. And we found particularly that married people are happy. We found one particularly interesting result is that the unemployed are unhappy everywhere. Now, people might say that's not a surprise, but it's a particularly large result. And the important things we see are really a marriage. Parental divorce in the past has a negative effect on people, but non-economic, non-money things appear to be what drives, the happiness index.
And you translate those into units that you can tie over to dollars. You say a divorce imposes an emotional toll of about $66,000 a year, a lasting marriage, $100,000 gain, a regular sex life, a $50,000 gain. And exactly how do you put the dollar figure on
that? Well, the way we do it is it's a fairly sophisticated procedure to do, but it's kind of simple. You just say how much units of happiness, if you like, does a dollar buy? Okay, well, let's see how many units of happiness a marriage buys. Well, then you can divide one by the other, and you can say, to get the same amount of happiness you get from marriage, it would take this number of units of money. And so then we can scale things that way. It's just trying to get, if you like, the things the economists have looked at in the past. If you've ever done an economics class,
yep,
we talk about utility. Well, we want a measure of things that are hard to put together. A ride on an elephant and a meal at McDonald's, we want to scale it somehow. So we in economics have talked about utility, and now we're going out in the world trying to measure it.
So $100,000 a year of additional income might buy you, you're suggesting, happiness on a par with that of a lasting marriage. Ed Diener, you're describing a whole range of things, many not monetary, satisfaction with life, work and marriage, positive feelings, feelings of trust in other people, security, meaning and purpose in life, low levels of depression, engagement, interest at work. Can you put all these into an economic schema?
We would include all of those in a National Accounts Index. And, you know, just like economic indices, we have a major one, GDP, but we have savings rate, unemployment rate, interest rates, and it would be the same with the well-being indicators. We could have some of the major indexes, like how happy and satisfied people are, and then some of the secondary things, how stressed people are, how much do they trust other people, do they feel secure, and those kind of things. And one of the things I think we found is that we've been worried about the validity of these measures. Can you really assess validly happiness? And I'm convinced now that the measures aren't perfect. They do have some problems, but they're probably about as good as the economic measures. I don't think they're worse.
And you get them simply by asking people, how happy are you? And you just take their reply, whatever it is, I guess.
That's right. And those measures where you just ask people and they give you a number, we validate it against all kinds of other measures. We validate them against how often they smile, what their friends and family say about them. Other people have validated them against brain areas that light up when you're happy. So there's a whole series of reasons to believe. Now, could a person lie? Of course they can lie. But we find that in these national surveys, most people don't lie. Their answers are reasonably accurate.
And what you'd like to do with this is develop a kind of national account or index of well-being. To what end, Ed Diener?
Well, to two ends. One is to help policymakers. So if you wonder, gee, we've got commuting. People want to go from downtown out to the suburbs. Should we build more freeways? We've got a heck of a mess right now. And so people say to themselves, gee, if I commute out there, I can get a bigger house, and it's going to be cheaper, and I can have a lawn. Don't live in downtown. Should I do that? And what we can tell them is, hey, you know, probably the least happy part of your day is commuting. If you can, and how much happiness then does a big house give you? And with national indicators, we can tell them that on average. Then a person can make a choice. Do I want to commute, knowing that most people are happier if they live closer to their work? And they can choose. On the other hand, the government can find out about some of these things. For example, the unemployment thing that Dr. Blanchflower mentioned. Now, what we found about unemployment was, even after people get a job back, and even after their income has returned just about to where it was before, they've still been scarred by the experience. That is, their life satisfaction is still lower. So now knowing that, you know, the government may act on it or may not, but policies can start to worry about that kind of thing, not simply, you know, are people making money?
So you're looking at this as a driver of national policy, not just piling up cash in the bank or the national GDP, but a more nuanced thing. Exactly, is this producing a happier nation or not? Let me ask you this. You point out that over the last half century or so, America's happiness has not jumped up that much while its GDP has tripled. Are you suggesting that if this had been managed differently, that the happiness really would have gone up more? Or is there kind of a general level of happiness at which a certain population is likely to find itself regardless of circumstances?
I think that it could increase. Now, it's true that what you may be getting at is, sure, people have a temperament, and some of that temperament is inborn, and that's going to limit how happy somebody can be. That is, they will have a range, but they can be at the bottom of that range or the top of that range, depending on what's happening. And we've found that although there is a baseline or set point for happiness, that can move. Things can happen to you to make that set point move up or down. And some of those things can be national things. We see that in Russia and the former communist countries. Their happiness is absolutely plunged. They gave up their ideology. They have insecurity. Their economic system's in collapse. And there's a transition period where most people in those countries had a really substantial decline, showing that society-wide things can matter, not just your temperament.
They're way down there, Russia, Argentina, Bulgaria, Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru at the bottom of the barrel in the chart I'm looking at. David Blanchflower, Ed Diener, Jack, if you'd permit me, I'd like to bring into our conversation Carol Graham. She's joining us from Washington. She's senior fellow and co-director of the Center on Social and Economic Dynamics at the Brookings Institution, co-author of the book Happiness and Hardship, Opportunity and Insecurity in New Market Economies. Good evening and welcome, Carol Graham.
Yes, good Good evening.
It's great to have you. There you are down in Washington, Brookings Institution, thinking all the time about policy issues, and you just had a big conference on happiness economics. How would you describe the level of interest in this right now, Carol? Are people looking at this as the future of policy underpinning?
I wouldn't go that far. I think there are people who are looking for broader measures of measuring progress, measuring well-being, that find this very interesting. I think there are people that wonder about, is our fiscal policy correct, that finds some of these findings extremely compelling, because that if you look at only income measures, you would get a very different take on what makes people better off than if you look at these surveys of well-being and you realize the very, very important effects that good health has, that that stable employment has, that stable marriage has, as David and Ed have mentioned. I think another potential tool that these surveys can provide is for measuring levels of unrest in societies, and this is particularly in societies abroad, developing societies. If one looks at just income measures of progress, a particular society may look as though everything's fine, and yet if you conduct a well-being survey in the same society, you may find that there's a tremendous amount of frustration. Ed mentioned Russia. That's a more obvious case, but there, certainly in our research and in the book that you cited, we find evidence of tremendous public frustration among upwardly mobile people in fast-growing societies. And that is certainly an eye-opener to policymakers who are interested is globalization sustainable? Which societies are likely to be stable? Where do people support democracy?
On the other hand, we see in the chart I'm looking at here again, countries like China, India, even Bangladesh, still relatively quite low per capita incomes, but way up high on the happiness chart, right behind Portugal, France, Japan, right in that league.
Well, that's exactly the point, that if you just are looking at income, a much poorer society may be much more, may have higher average happiness levels, and it's not just, there is no linear correlation between income and happiness after a certain point, and that there are other things that these surveys capture. For example, the effects of inequality on happiness, something we've worked on a lot, trying to capture better. The effects of changes in economic structures and systems and how those affect happiness. Certainly that's the case in Russia. We also find that's the case in Peru, where you have winners and losers with particular kinds of economic changes, with the effects of globalization. And you find very unlikely suspects that could be happy. It may be upwardly mobile people who are unhappy because they feel that others around them are doing better, even though by objective income measures, they are doing relatively well.
Inequality, reform, revolution, sex, we've got a lot of things hopping here. I want to invite our callers in to comment. Chris is calling from Boston. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm just recently became a teacher a year ago, and I have to say I'm much, much happier as a result, switching professions. I mean, I was working in public relations before that. I think a happiness index is a terrific idea. My question is, or my sort of what I'm wondering is, as these statistics become published, Americans being such great consumers of this kind of information as they are, will people then start to compete for the things that are on the scale as providing greater amounts of happiness?
So driving up the competition for marriage for whatever makes people happy? It's an interesting question. David Blanchflower, what do you say?
Well, the more information, the better. I mean, I'm a believer in the market. I was going to extend on some of the things that the other two commentators were making. I think the ultimate benefit, in fact, of these kinds of indices would ultimately be whether they have predictive power or not. You might think if this is a really good measure of the welfare or how well the economy is feeling, how the people are feeling, you might think it would predict election results. I think its ultimate test, if we can get there, would be how well it's going to predict things compared to other indicators, and then we'll see people responding to that. But I think it actually will, but we've yet to really be able to show that we can predict people's behavior with that index. But that's not a reason not to do it. That's a reason to do it and develop it and make it a good index that people can then respond to.
You're speculating, I've seen recently at this Brookings conference, that lawyers, maybe trial lawyers, may be watching this closely. If you lose a marriage, if you lose a spouse, you're beginning to put a price tag on exactly what happiness that costs.
Yes, I think that's right. We're trying to scale things. Let others come in.
Yeah, no, yeah. I just wanted to jump in,
Carol Graham.
David, if that's all right, on this whole issue of predictive tools. And I agree with David, we're not there yet by any means, but it's exactly where this could be an incredibly useful tool. We certainly have some suggestions, and I think some of the psychological evidence shows that people that are happier, that have higher levels of reported well-being, do better in the labor market, they're healthier in the future. And then this whole issue of can we use these indicators of predictive tools in terms of what's going to happen to societies, what's going to happen in terms of political outcomes, in terms of economic outcomes. Certainly our work finds very strong linkages between how people report their well-being and their attitudes about things like free trade and market policies in developing countries, about democracy, about redistribution, about a whole host of very policy-relevant things.
Jack Beattie, let me get you in here. I wonder what you think as you listen to this whole conversation. Is this suggesting a kind of new stab at social engineering that's beyond the nuance of society, of government, or do you think you could take a happiness index and then really go to work on the society to shape it to maximize?
Well, you know, you could certainly get objective and agreed measures on things like environmental health and on and environmental quality and personal health and things like that that are amenable to government policy. After all, if you go to a doctor and get cared for, you're apt to be happier than if, because you have no insurance, you can't. If you live around a plant that pollutes, you're not apt to be happy. If you don't live there, you'd be happier. And government policy can affect those big things. But you know, it's the stuff. What strikes me is the way the causation runs the other way, from the economy to unhappiness. I mean, according to things I've seen, someone born after 1955 is three times more likely to have an incident of major depression and even chronic depression, sadness, paralyzing dejection, than his grandparents. And
his grandparents lived through the Depression, though, Jack.
Right. Isn't that something? Well, what has happened since 1955? Well, if you look at the economic sphere, I mean, what do you have? You have rampant and economic insecurity, insecurity of your job, insecurity of your industry. In effect, economic insecurity replicates some of the conditions of depression, disapproval, judging you, weighing you. You've got an economy that has a myriad of choices, and choices always add to the frustration. I can't have everything, but I want everything, and everything is on order, and on and on and on. And finally, the nature of goods in the modern economy. They are increasingly positional goods. They're good because I've got them and you don't. I've got the house on the shore, and you don't. I've got the Harvard education, and you don't. They're intrinsically hostile and competitive. That doesn't make for happiness.
But, Jack, it makes you sound like a natural-born happiness economist. We've got to take a short break. Carol Graham, I know I've got to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us tonight from the Brookings Institution in Washington. Listeners, you can join us tonight. Why are we three times richer than our grandparents, but no happier? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the economics of happiness, about sex, money, power, commuting, and the elements of well-being, about how much in dollar terms a marriage is worth, a sense of security is worth, a year of sex is worth. You can join us tonight. What makes you happy? What's your formula for happiness? If we measured national success by a happiness index, how might society change? And here's one for you. Why has the happiness of white women taken the biggest hit since the 1970s? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Dartmouth College economist David Blanchflower, co-author of the new study, Money, Sex, and Happiness, and from Champaign, Illinois, by Ed Diener, psychology professor at the University of Illinois and co-author of Beyond Money, Toward an Economy of Well-Being. Jack Beattie's with us as well, and right now Jim is calling from Long Island in New York. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Tom, I was going to say that the biggest happiness money correlation that I can come up with is the purchasing power that the consumer has. I do believe in the Western countries that we have the greatest amount of credit and cash flow available with the higher incomes and higher credits, we're able to purchase the necessities of life easier, and that, you know, correlates to higher happiness. And I do believe China, India, and some of those other countries that are emerging that do not have very high incomes but are emerging as happier countries, I do believe their consumer power has went up and they're able to purchase more goods and services for their money.
So you're saying it's pretty simple. It's about purchasing power. Let's get our guest response. Ed Diener, what do you say to that?
I say, of course, India and China have tremendously growing economies. And remember, they're down there at that lower level. We've studied people in Calcutta a lot. Some of them can't eat every day. And when you have growth rates down at those lower levels, then you're going to get increases in happiness. And I think that's exactly what we've seen in India.
You mean growth rates off of a low base equals happiness, high growth off low base.
Now you're talking about basic needs. And once you get to the higher levels and you're still using the model of scarcity, that is, we don't have enough, but now you're saying, well, do we need 20 shirts or 40 shirts? We're no longer dealing with that kind of scarcity. And now we're talking about human relationships and the kinds of things that are not necessarily in the market. So the things we've been talking about that really matter in our society, trust in other people, close interpersonal relationships, and so forth. Chris, the other caller, was worried, gee, maybe we'll get in competition. Well, the nice thing is some of these things are not positional goods. They're goods that everybody can have.
You mean, so it's not all about keeping up with the Joneses, deciding whether or not, for example, you stay in a marriage?
Exactly. And, you know, your wife and you can have sex once every 10 years or once every night, and what your neighbors are doing doesn't matter. And most people don't know much about their neighbor's sex life. So it's not a competitive thing that we're pointing to here.
But David Blanchflower, you've looked at exactly that, and you say sexual frequency is a major happiness indicator.
The economist would say that's what the data says. Perhaps it's unsurprising. I mean, some of my economist friends wrote to me and said, well, isn't that the most obvious thing you've ever written about? You know, people get happiness from
Hello.
Sex.
Hello. Right.
Hello, duh. Yes, that's true, but I guess we proved it and we measured it, and the numbers we get are substantial.
And you found that people with more money don't necessarily get more sex. So to Jim's call from Long Island, purchasing power may not be the last word once you get above a certain level.
Well, I just wanted to add another thing. I remember hearing at the other end, when we've talked about at low income levels, you get more money, it makes you happier. I remember I heard a story where Arnold Schwarzenegger said that I don't get as much happiness from the 30th million as I got from the first million. And that's the other end of the story.
All about that diminishing return. Let's get another call. Yeah. Joanna's calling from Osterville, Massachusetts. Hi, Joanna. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
I am so happy that you are doing a program on this. I think it's desperately important.
Well, our national index is spiking then, Joanna.
Yes, indeed.
Absolutely and relatively.
and why? Why?
Well, I think, first of all, it goes to the heart of our of some of the principles on which our very nation was founded. The preamble to the Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. after all, exalts the pursuit of happiness. And so if we don't measure that, we really don't know how well our culture is doing. So I think it's very much worthwhile. I find, rather than purchasing power, that for me personally, my degree of happiness rises and falls depending on how much control I have over my time.
Control over time, something you can't exactly put a price on, yet it's related often to, sometimes, to wealth or income.
Well, it's true, and I think that it's one of the easier criteria to measure, because you can look at to what extent people are willing to give up a certain amount of income for purposes of having more time, and to bring up the issue of lawyers again, and to connect it as well to why it could be that white women are so much less happy, is because I think in part white women have been some of the greatest beneficiaries of the success of equal opportunity enforcement in terms of the laws.
Right, more opportunity.
More opportunity to make gains in the workplace. But what's also happened at the same time is that I think it's been measured that there's more time required of people. People are working more hours rather than fewer hours, and women aren't seeing at the same time that their having fewer responsibilities on the home front, so they have less control of their time.
So it's all on their shoulder, even though they may have a higher income. They may sit higher in purchasing power. Joanna, thanks so much for calling. Let's get one more call. Michael's calling from Medford, Mass. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey. I wanted to make a comment and a question.
Yeah.
I just want to follow up on the previous caller and say how excited I am that this research, which comes out of the positive psychology movement, continues to capture people's interest in building all the relevance of psychological study and research, focusing on what works and not just on pathology and disease. Now we're focusing on what makes people have more ease. But the question I have is, what does this study say in the context of the culture wars? And the question is, what lifestyle profile is most likely to be happy, according to the research? And then which political agenda on the conservative or liberal side of things is most validated by the profile that emerges?
So you're bolting it right into current events. Michael, thanks so much for the call, and our time is short. Ed Diener, I'm going to give you the first swing at that.
I think these measures are absolutely politically neutral. We find, for example, if you think of super religiousness as being a more conservative thing, religious people are happier in almost all the surveys. On the other hand, you see things supporting liberal viewpoints, things like green space being important. So I think the measures actually show that each side has something to say about happiness that's valuable.
David Blanchflower, just half a minute left. Do you agree? Are these measures, would this index be politically neutral?
I think Ed Diener said it very well, and I agree with everything he said. The psychologists get the say on this one.
Well, simple as that. Jack Beattie, what do you say? I have a feeling you may have a different view, but have at it.
What's that Gilbert and Sullivan line about every little, the little liberal and the little conservative, and we are, I can understand that there would have to be a kind of balance of the two that would make people happy. After all, if you just lived by tradition, you wouldn't be happy, the conservative extreme. And on the other hand, if you just lived according to, experiment and trying new things, you could hardly be happy. So, yes, Aristotle here, as elsewhere, as everywhere, is right. The middle is the place to be.
The middle. We're right in the middle of happiness economics. We're going to be watching this, following. It's very interesting, very exciting. Thanks to our guest tonight for being with us, Ed Diener in Champaign, Illinois, professor of psychology at the U of I. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Good night, Tom.
Good night. And David Blanchflower at Hanover, New Hampshire, economics professor at Dartmouth, author of Money, Sex, and Happiness. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Jack, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, the woman charged with styling the bigwig's hair at the Democratic National Convention. This is On Point. In the race for the White House this year, John Kerry claims he's got the winning ticket because he and John Edwards have better hair. And the woman in charge of styling that hair for the Democratic National Convention is Connie Sullivan. The Newton, Massachusetts stylist was tapped to crop all the top mops for the DNC. Connie Sullivan has 38 years' experience styling famous heads from around the world, but as official stylist for VIPs at the convention, she'll be the last line of defense against frizz and flyaways before Kerry, Edwards, Clinton, and Kennedy step up to the podium in Boston. On Point went to Connie Sullivan's Genesis Salon, where she told us that styling the Democrats' dues isn't just cut and dry.
We've got a better sense of what's happening to America, and we've got better hair. I'll tell you, that goes a long way.
It was really funny that he said that, because that someone expected that we have better hair.
Do they have better
hair? They really do have better hair, but I don't know what it had to do with anything, but they do have better hair. We had to put together a team of 12. It's going to be a blast for us. In fact, I hope they let us take our pictures with each and every one of them. That's the most exciting part of it for me, I think. Because fixing them will be seconds, a minute. Remember, I think they're already well-groomed. I mean, they look good. I think the best thing we can do is just make them look their best. Probably tame it down a little bit of gel. I'm sure none of them use hairspray. but it'll all be product, I think, on men. And then as far as the makeup artists are concerned, I think it'll be maybe tanning powder, just a little bit of something so they won't be so shiny.
Yeah.
Hair is important. Look what they look like when they went in, and look at them now. 1,000% improvement. I would say that Carrie's hair is probably a little wild, so he would need something to sort of tame it and hold it down. Edwin sort of looks like he has sort of fine hair, so it's a little liner on top. It almost looks like he needs something to keep it in place, maybe a little liquid spray or something. Clinton probably looks like a hair cream of some kind, another head of hair that sort of sticks up. And as far as Kennedy, I really think he does need hair product because his is always wild and disheveled, and not that we want it all in place, but and you can tell he barely uses anything. If you recall when Clinton, you know, when he was first in the White House, and Hillary, I mean, they were hideous looking. I mean, she had hair down, I think, the middle of her back, and she wore headbands, and that certainly isn't the look of a first lady. And I think it was a long time that she struggled trying to find the right person, because each stage they put her through, and then everybody, she went through so many hairdressers, and finally, whoever does it now, it's controlled, and it looks good. But it took her a long time, and same with Clinton. If you recall, he had some very famous hairdresser, drove him by limo to the airplane to this haircut, and it was embarrassing to look at the finished product. It was sticking out like a porcupine. Everybody sort of makes comments about Teresa Hines. I mean, everybody's saying, oh, she needs to do something with her hair. I think she looks like a free spirit, a person that likes to see her hair sort of move around. And you can tell by the way she moves her head. She likes her hair to move with her. You know, unlike a lot of the political wives that you see, it's so sprayed, I think they could bounce off something. You know, it's her hair, it's her hair. It's terrible. That's the way she wants it to be. It could look better, but still, if she likes it that free, that casual, or that loose, then let her wear it that way. I think that people expect too much from their hair. I think that we have to allow it to let it do basically what it wants. If we want to restructure it, like people straighten it to make it look less frizzy, less curly, or people perm it to make it more curly. But I think that people have to, you know, realize the fact that this is their hair and this is what they have to deal with, so we have to deal with the same thing. We can only make it look better. So my philosophy would be, as it always has been, that allow the hair to be what it wants to be. We can change the structure of it. We can change the texture of it. But we can't change the hair. So I think you have to go along with it. What can I tell you? Here's a party over there.
Connie Sullivan is owner of the Genesis Salon in Newton, Massachusetts. Sullivan and a team of 12 stylists will be working with the hair of John Kerry, John Edwards, and all the party bigwigs at the Democratic National Convention in Boston. Hope it makes them happy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Be one,